My name is Rebecca Parker, and I'd like to welcome all of you to this session this afternoon. The title of this session is Beyond Submission, Reimagining the Relationship of the Soul to God. And what I'd like to do is follow a format like this, just so you're a little bit prepared. I'd like to give about a 20 or 25 minute presentation of some ideas, and then we'll take some time to discuss those however long we want, and depending on how much discussion we have, I'll either present some more things or we'll leave some things for part two, which will be on Thursday afternoon. I'd like to begin with an observation, and it's an observation that you perhaps can make for me. I've written up here on the board three kinds of relationships: husband, wife, king, subject, parent, child. I would like to ask you to answer this question for me. In most of our imagery of the relationship of soul to God, often we use these metaphors, these human relationships, as metaphors for the relationship of soul to God. Most often when we use these metaphors, can you tell me which partner in this pair is God in each case? In the case of the first one, is it husband or wife? Which one? Husband plays the part of God. King or subject?
King.
King. Parent or child?
Parent.
All right, you know everything I have to teach you. The observation I'd like to make is that we know that we always speak about God, or often speak about God, in metaphorical language, images or symbols. And we often use language of human relationship for speaking about God. Traditionally, in Christian piety and spirituality, the relationship between God and the soul has been imaged as a dominant and submissive relationship. Those are perhaps the strongest words to use. The word dominant comes from the Latin domine, Lord. So the Lord-subject relationship is the kind of relationship that we imagine the relationship between God and the soul to be. This metaphor is so familiar to us, we can all think of examples of it. Some that come readily to mind are the language of hymnody. And in the language of many hymns, we speak about the believer's desire or responsibility to submit to God. And submission means it means a lot of things, and actually the meaning of submission is something we may want to discuss more about, because I'm not going to reflect too much about that. But submission can mean submitting our will, not my will, but thy will be done, submitting our desires, not what I desire, but what you desire, submitting our feelings, let me not feel this inappropriate feeling, but feel as you would have me feel, submitting our gifts, let me not use my gifts for my own ends or for someone else's ends, but let me use my gifts for your purposes. And those are some samples of what submission means. To remind you of some of the hymns, one of the ones that was most popular when I was growing up was the one about I am the potter, you are the potter, I am the clay. Do you know that one? Have thine own way, Lord, have thine own way. Anybody else know this by heart? You are the potter, I am the clay. Mold me and make me after thy will while I am waiting, yielded and still. That's language of submission. Let me give you some other examples. There's another 19th century American hymn with similar theology, take my life and let it be. In other words, let me give my whole life to you, submit my whole life to you. You probably know this by heart too. The last verse speaks about submission of the will to God. Take my will and make it thine. It shall be no longer mine. Take my heart, it is thine own. It shall be thy royal throne. There's the king subject imagery. Take my love, My Lord, I pour at thy feet its treasure store. Take myself. I will be ever only all for thee. imagery of submitting ourselves to God is not just in popular piety like those hymns, but you also find it in the mystical tradition, and sometimes in very, very vivid language. And here, for example, is a prayer of the modern mystic and social activist Simone Weil, who says, "May God grant that I become nothing. Insofar as I become nothing, God loves himself through me." So she seeks to submit herself so completely to God that it's as if she no longer exists and only God exists through her. And we have this language in the New Testament, in where Paul writes, "It's not I who lives, but Christ who lives through me. I die, and Christ lives through me." The medieval mystic Richard of St. Victor uses a lot of language of submission, and in his language you can see the husband and wife metaphor. Another thing I'd like you to observe about this tradition is that often the soul is imaged as female and as stereotypically female. The ideal soul is and we've all learned this at church, the ideal soul submits her will, herself, entirely to her master or husband or lord. Those are all synonyms. And she has relinquished any will or desires of her own and has become completely obedient to the will of the master, lord, to the holy one. And you can, this is explicit in Richard of St. Victor's writing. Let me just read you some of this. He talks about the stages of love for God, stages in our relationship to God. Some of you may know Richard of St. Victor. And his highest stage is the third stage, the third degree of love. And this is how he speaks about submission. "Those who have reached the third degree of love do nothing according to their own will. They leave nothing at their own desire, but commit all things to the providence of God. Every wish or desire of theirs hangs upon God's sign and awaits the divine good pleasure. The soul applies herself," that's his language, "herself in this degree to be readily at the beck and call of the divine will. Indeed, she adapts herself with spontaneous desire to every demand of God and adjusts her own will as the divine good pleasure requires. And as liquefied metal runs down easily wherever a passage is open, so the soul humbles herself spontaneously to be obedient in this way and freely bows herself in all acts of humility according to divine providence." That's some more traditional mystical language. Or again from a 20th century mystic, Teilhard de Chardin, and listen to this prayer and notice how this language of submission includes associations with vanquishment of vanquishment of the self. He writes, "Lord, lock me up in the deepest depths of your heart, and then holding me there, burn me, purify me, set me on fire, sublimate me till I become utterly what you would have me be through the complete annihilation of my ego." Now, these are just some examples to remind you of this of the theme of submission in our relationship to God. Now, the idea that the right way for us to be related to God is to submit ourselves to the will of God, and if necessary, to remove from ourselves anything that would keep us from being able to be completely submissive to the will of God, is connected to how we understand salvation, sin and salvation. And then this is a big subject, so again, I want to just say something very sketchy. Traditionally, or in our Orthodox theology, our original sin of the human family is our disobedience or our rebelliousness, our unwillingness to let God be God and to be the creature who submits to God as rule. Bonhoeffer, a very clear 20th century interpreter of the understanding of our original sin, says that our sin is that we don't want to be creatures. We don't want to be subjects. We want to be God instead. We want to be in charge. We want to be in power. We want to be husband, king, and parent, I guess. we want to be the creator of the universe and in charge of everything. This is our innate sinfulness, is this desire for power. And our fall came about because we rebelled against God's rule, refused to follow God's commands, transgressed against the limits that were introduced to us in the beginning of creation. And so our disobedience is our fundamental sinful act. Our salvation is, and again, there are many ways that we look at this, but our salvation is brought about by Christ, who frees us from the punishment that we deserve because of our disobedience. This is one of the ways we talk about salvation. There are some others. But because we are disobedient and rebellious children, the biblical imagery of rebellion speaks of us as rebellious children, or also uses, actually predominantly, the image of human beings as a rebellious wife who has been unfaithful to her husband. This is the imagery we find in the prophets all the time. Israel, the community, is an adulterous wife who hasn't remained faithful, who's rebelled against the love of God and the authority of God, hasn't followed the commands. So because of our disobedience, we deserve to be punished, because our disobedience shows lack of respect for God, lack of love for God, and we deserve to be punished. But God, in God's mercy, wants us to not have to endure the punishment we deserve. So Christ is sent, Jesus is sent on with the call from God that he is to bear the punishment that we deserve, become the sacrificial lamb on the cross, and because of his willingness to be obedient to his Father's requirement, Jesus is the obedient child to the parent of God, perfectly obedient even unto death, it says in Philippians. Because of Jesus' perfect obedience and his willingness to bear the suffering, we have been freed from the punishment we deserve. And this is a gift to us, which we are to receive as grace. But then there's the catch in our tradition is that we have been set free for obedience. So we have a new chance, freed from the threat of punishment and the reality of punishment, a new chance to enter into a faithful relationship with God, which means one in which we are obedient to God's rule. Is this familiar theology to you? So the language of submission is a language about the state of the way in which we are to live after we have received the grace of God. It's the new life we are freed to enter into is a life of submission and obedience. Now, this was just to remind you of this theology, which is, I'm a Methodist, and I didn't give you the Methodist version. I was kind of sort of trying to give you the Lutheran version. I don't know how close I was, for those of you who are Lutherans. Methodist version is pretty close to the same. Now, what I want to do is to share with you some critical questions about this whole theological heritage, and especially the notion that a sanctified life is a life of increasing obedience and submission. And you may, this theology that I have just tried to describe may be very important to you. It may be the essence of your religious life. It may be a theology that you have never found meaningful. It may be a theology that you have ambiguous feelings about. I mean, we probably have diverse relationships to this theology. So the questions I want to raise are meant to spark some reflection, and they're very critical questions. So if the theology I've described is the essence of your religious commitment, I hope you will receive these criticisms in a spirit of a struggle to discern what fullness of life is. And if I disturb you a whole lot and you want to talk to me about it some more privately or in another setting, I'm quite open and happy to do that. So there have been a variety of critical questions raised by different voices, different people about this theology. They come from a variety of disciplines. Some of them are theological, some are psychological, some are political, and some are from theoretical psychology, some are from clinical experience in psychology. So I'd like to sketch out some of these and connect them to some of the people who've raised the criticisms. First of all, I'd like to tell you about the work of Dorothee Zolle. Some of you know this German liberation theologian, feminist. And she published a book a number of years ago called Beyond Mere Obedience. It's kind of hard to track down. But it's a discussion about obedience, the theme of obedience in theology. And she starts the book with a quote. And the quote is from an autobiographical statement from someone's diary or from their autobiography, and I don't have the text with me, but it's telling about the person's childhood, and it says, I was raised in a home where I was taught that the most important things in life were to honor my mother and father and to seek in all things to be faithful to God. And this teaching was reinforced in my school experience with the extension of the idea that I also should honor and respect my teachers, and do as they say, and that loyalty and faithfulness to those who were my superiors was one of the signs of a Christian life. The writer goes on to say, I've always found this to be the cornerstone of my commitment as a person. And after this quote, which I'm sort of paraphrasing, not sort of, I'm actually paraphrasing, we find out that the writer of this little autobiographical statement was the director of Auschwitz. And Dorothee Zolle reflects in this book on the connection between the Protestant theology of obedience and the rise to power of the Nazis in Germany. And she makes the observation that most of those who became involved in the Nazi movement believed deeply in the notion that righteousness and obedience are identical. And to be faithful to the authorities above one, to submit yourself to the rule of the authorities above you, is a virtuous act. And because Dorothee Zolle is a German, and as she is trying to understand her country's collective sin, she comes to the conclusion that the way the church has talked about obedience has contributed to the social sin of Nazism. Because, she says, that a religion that cultivates obedience as the highest ideal ceases to ask people to rebel when it would be appropriate to rebel. It's an interesting critical question. Now, she wrote this book before Watergate and before our most recent experiences in American politics, but we know that that the Watergate experience in the 70s in the United States also happened because people believed that being loyal and obedient to the authorities over them was an essential thing to a righteous life. And in the trial of Ollie North that was concluded recently, the jurors commented that and North was really acquitted of most of the charges against him, and he was acquitted because he was following orders. He was being obedient to another authority that he believed he should be obedient to. And the jurors believed that there was a person could not be held accountable for their actions if what they were doing was following orders. So the political criticism of obedience that Zsolle raises is that obedience theology contributes to freeing people from responsibility for their actions. And we all know that in the name of God, in the name of obedience to God, various atrocities have been committed. That's one critical question, one critical voice. Then there are some other critical voices similar to that one. And the closest is the criticism that Karl Marx raises of religion. You all have heard the saying that from the Communist Manifesto that religion is the opium of the people. Now, Marx's criticism of religion is actually much more interesting than we usually think when we just know that reduction of that part of it. What Marx observed about religion was he said that this is what happens psychologically to people in the religion that he knew. People project onto something outside of themselves, preferably God, an authority outside of themselves, all that is most virtuous, and then see themselves as or else project onto others everything that is most terrible. And then they seek the favor of the most virtuous by trying to be obedient to them and seek to repress those who symbolize what is most sinful. But basically, I don't think I'm explaining this too well, what he says is that this psychological projection frees human beings from having to take responsibility for doing good, and the divine authority outside, preferably God, is the one who's seen as the source of all good, the only one who can do good. Human beings can't do any good, and so human beings are freed from responsibility for acting in the world. So religion cultivates, in Marx's view, passivity. And submission is, in his understanding, a form of passivity. We know the popular phrase, let go and let God. Marx calls that, that's what Marx means by the opium of the people. That God is the one who takes care of everything, and all you have to do is wait for God to take care of everything, because God knows what's good, not God knows what's right. God is the creative one, the loving one, the just one, and the powerful one. And I am the the incapable one, the sinner, and the best I can do and what I should do is stop doing anything, because whatever I do, I can do no good. Remember where Paul, bless his heart, says this? Everything, even when I try to do good, I can't do anything good. Can't do anything well. No, he couldn't do anything good. Maybe he could do some things well. I can do nothing good. Only God can do something good. Everything that I do is evil or is messed up. And so what I should do is stop doing anything and wait for God. And then the right things will happen. Think back about that the language of submission. The believer seeks to do nothing on her own, using the language of the mystics. The soul waits for God to act. And the really holy person does not do anything of her own at all, but God acts through her. She becomes completely a channel. I had a friend who ended up seriously emotionally ill, and spent considerable length of time in the psych ward in the hospital in my community. Because she was trying so hard to apply the theology, let go and let God. And she was unemployed, and she was waiting for a job, for God to give her a job. And so pretty soon she was really hungry, and hunger doesn't help one's mental state. And she degenerated into complete helplessness, because she took that theology so seriously. That raised questions for me about the theology. Now, Marx's criticism of religion as the opium of the people, in other words, what it does, what he means by that image, is that religion of spirituality of submission frees people from having to act. So it's like being in an opium haze. You no longer have to be a participant in life. You're just a receiver or a channel. That leads us into some clinical observations that made by people working in the field of drug dependency and the 12-step process. Some of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the 12-step process. What people working with the experience of addiction have increasingly learned is that addiction involves surrendering one's power to a power outside of oneself, and letting and becoming a slave to that power outside of oneself. So addiction to alcohol is a form of is dependence on something outside of oneself instead of living one's own life. The addictive substance becomes the ruler of one's life. This is the clinical experience. And the process of healing requires that people move out of dependence and become more self-responsible. This is a very difficult and long process often for people. And basically, becoming free from chemical dependency or any other kind of dependency involves breaking the structure of dominance and submission. Sometimes clinical experience, I was just talking to somebody this morning who's a clinical social worker. Sometimes in the process of trying to break a dependency on a drug or in a human relationship, people substitute the drug for a religious object. So instead of alcohol being the thing that determines all of one's choices, or around which one's life circles. God can function that way, or Jesus, or a religious leader who symbolizes the ultimate authority. And that's not always... often it's a physical progress to substitute God for an addictive drug, which is so destructive of the body. But the clinical social workers and I think emphasize that that full healing involves a transformed relationship to God, not one in which God is functioning like in the same pattern as the drug was functioning. And there's a lot more that could be said about that, but let me just mention that briefly because I want us to have some discussion time. Another criticism of the spirituality of submission comes from ethnic theologians, especially Black theologians in working in America. The Black experience in America, we know, has its roots in the experience of slavery. And Black people come out of a heritage in which they were literally slaves to masters. And the history of Black religion, the master-slave relationship, became the model imagery for the relationship between the self and Jesus. Jesus is my master, and no one else. And I am the believer am the servant of Jesus. That relationship becomes central. And Jesus is a good master who is going to set me free in the life to come. You'll get pie in the sky when you die. This form of Black religion, this is not the only form of Black religion by any means, but it's one of the forms of Black religion, was the style of religion that Martin Luther King was raised in. And King, as a young and very thoughtful person, rejected his religious heritage and decided that no Black, self-respecting Black person should be a Christian, because he thought that the religion made Black people passive to injustice. So it made them patient with injustice in this world, with the promise of justice in another world, and it just substituted one master for another. And King was angry at the passivity of his people in the face of injustice. And that critical response on his part was the beginning of the evolution of his theology. And he was exposed to the thinking of Walter Rauschenbusch. Some of you know about Walter Rauschenbusch? Rauschenbusch was a Baptist at the end of the 19th century who also raised questions about submissive theology. And he said that Rauschenbusch's criticism was the imagery of king and subject so prevalent in our religious language suggests that the essence of righteousness is obedience. That's what I was just describing in the beginning. And Rauschenbusch said, the essence of righteousness is not obedience. The essence of righteousness is how I treat my neighbor. And so Rauschenbusch said that the king subject language presented distracted people from their relationships with one another. And people were so busy trying to be obedient to God to save their souls or to express their salvation that they weren't paying any attention to how they were living with one another or to the social dimensions of sin. And Rauschenbusch writes, let me just release this because it's kind of, his language is sort of beautiful. he says, In an absolute monarchy, the first duty is to bow to the royal will. When theological definitions speak of rebellion against God as the common characteristic of all sin, it reminds one of the readiness of despotic governments to treat every offense as treason. And then he says, our universe is not a despotic monarchy with God above the starry canopy and ourselves down here. It is a spiritual commonwealth with God in the midst of us. So Rauschenbusch said that instead of thinking about sin as disobedience, we should think about it as broken relationships with one another. And instead of thinking of God as the ruler to whom we should obey, we should think of God as the naked, the hungry, the poor, and how we relate to them is how we relate to God. And what's required of us when we meet the naked, the hungry, the poor, is not obedience, but responsive love and actions for justice and service. So King encountered this way of thinking, and that began his own theological development, taking off from Rauschenbusch. It was because of Rauschenbusch that King decided to stay a Christian and stay involved in the church, and went on to become a pastor. But in his own theology then, as a black leader, which he became, King rejected the master-slave submission kind of spirituality and emphasized and formulated very clearly a spirituality of social involvement and service to others. And that meant he asked people to act in history and to take responsibility for the good that they could do. So social activism is rooted in King's kind of social activism was rooted in a rejection of certain forms of submission or obedience. Okay, that's another critical tradition. Then finally, let me really quickly talk about the feminist critique of dominance and submission in the relationship to God. The feminist critique says that the problem with seeing our relationship as one in which we are asked to submit ourselves to God is that submission turns out to almost always function in life as a form of self-destruction. And feminists bring this critique from their critique of the notion that the male-female relationship, of the husband-wife relationship, is one in which the wife is to submit herself to the rule of the husband. Now, notion of, I'm not talking now about mutual submission, but about one-way submission. Okay, and the feminist critique of one-way submission is that the one who submits to the other always does so at the cost of her own self. In order to do someone else's will, you have to get rid of your own will if it is contrary to the other's will. To do someone else's desires, you have to get rid of your own desires, or you have to have no desires. When the soul seeks, when we try to relate to God as souls being perfectly submissive, it requires a kind of, it's what I would call excising of aspects of the self, a cutting away. And in the language of the mystics that I was reading to you at the beginning, I hope you noticed how often the language of submission includes words that have violent overtones. Teilhard de Chardin prays, lock me up. Richard of St. Victor speaks about the desire to be burned by God and melted. And he says the perfect soul is one who has been chastened, the chaste soul. And to be chastened is to be heated to the point of malleability. See, I just want you to notice the violent overtones in that. The radical feminist philosopher Mary Daly criticizes Maribel Morgan's idea about the total woman. Maribel Morgan describes the ways a woman should function as a submissive wife whose whole life is organized to please the master, king, lord, husband. Mary Daly says we shouldn't call this the total woman, but the totaled woman. And what she means is that in order to make yourself over into the image of the perfect subject, the perfect wife, or in order to completely be faithful to the will of another outside of you, you have to get rid of yourself and then become what the other says you should be. And so I think I will speak just personally as a woman. When I have tried to fulfill the spirituality of obedience, I have experienced all sorts of inner conflicts with those aspects of myself that don't fit with what I'm supposed to be. And I've found out that trying to be perfectly obedient to God finally and ultimately for me was an effort to disappear as a person, to not really be here, to not be a self. And when you think about it, this, the language of our tradition speaks about righteousness as the disappearance of the self, which is confusing. And this is the question I'm trying to raise. But I found that in order to feel like I could be completely faithful and obedient to God, I had to not desire anything. I had to not have any negative emotions. Couldn't be angry, I felt, because anger got in the way of me being good to people around me. I didn't want to be good to them. I wanted to throw plates at them. And so anger was not all right. And I had to not have a will of my own for myself, but had to seek to follow the will of another. And the feminist critique, to repeat, says that this is that submission always requires or amounts to self-destruction. So let me stop there because I went on longer than I wanted to, because I would like to have you have some chance to make some responses. What I've tried to do is point out some of the ways people have criticized the theology of obedience or submission. Haven't offered any answers, and there are some answers to these criticisms that I could also share with you. But I'll stop talking, and I'd like to give you a chance for some feedback. How would you answer these critiques? Or do these critiques connect to any of the questions that you have had?
The thought I have is this theology that you described, our theology, plays out real differently for me as a man than it does for you as a woman.
Mm-hmm.
I was just reading Matthew Fox quoting Gandhi that the original sin is separateness,
mm-hmm.
and that for me as a man, overcoming my separateness is a big part of my struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that's not unique to men, but it plays out particularly for men. And that I'm a Methodist and I came
mm-hmm.
to this by way of feminist theology.
Mm-hmm.
And while I agree with a lot of what you're saying, I also find where I am right now in my spiritual journey is that there's a lot of value for I prefer to say surrender,
mm-hmm.
or looking for merger with creation. And that that's particularly because of my situation as a man. So that doesn't really deny what you're saying. It's just something that pops up.
You use the phrase surrender to creation.
Yeah, and to Jesus Christ in creation.
In creation. Yeah. And surrender is a way of bridging isolation and becoming connected. So it's opening yourself to connectedness. Yeah.
Jumping to part two.
That is part two.
I'd like you to extend the logic a little bit of this idea that, as I think of reading in the papers a few years ago of the son of Sam and his murders, and he was acting in response to the voice that said, kill, kill, kill. And he was being obedient to that voice. But it's hard for me to jump then in logic to throwing out obedience. Here are some examples of people who are obedient to a voice, to whatever kind of chaos there is, and now because of that, those examples, we're going to throw out obedience to God. Say some more on how there is any logical progression there.
Yeah, I think that's the real important question. For one thing, many of the critical voices about obedience theology simply make it clear that we shouldn't be obedient to evil. the Nazis were obedient to those who were who ran the death camps were being obedient to commanders or visionaries who were evil, or Son of Sam. But is obedience itself wrong? Now, Dorothée Tsolle's analysis is a little bit more sophisticated than I presented it. She says that to cultivate obedience, that in fact we have associated obedience to God with obedience to earthly rulers in a variety of forms. So in the religion that she was criticizing, of her time and place, obedience to God also meant obedience to the rulers in authority. That's a kind of a Lutheran principle, Calvinist principle, but there's a lot of discussion about what that means. Obedience to parents, obedience to those who have authority over one. So there has historically often historically there's been an association between a theology of obedience to God and the notion of obedience to various levels of authority in life. Obedience to the Pope or obedience to the Church. For women, obedience to husbands. For slaves, obedience to masters. For subjects, obedience to kings. For students, obedience to teachers. For children, obedience to parents. Historically, those things have been amalgamated. Now, it may be that all of those human structures of obedience to authority we have learned, and our experience has shown, carry potential for tremendous evil. I mean, good can be done. If I'm obedient to my teacher and my teacher is telling me to do something good, it's fine. But if I believe obedience is a virtue and I'm obedient to my teacher and my teacher is telling me to do something terrible, then there's a vulnerability to tremendous evil. So it may be that what we need to throw out is the idea that obedience is a virtue in all these different kinds of relationships, because sometimes rebellion is a virtue. Now, in 19th century feminism and also in the Black Church, obedience to God has been a foundation not for faithfulness to human structures of authority, but a basis for rebellion. So, for example, the same theology that King criticized, Jesus is my master, and I'm his servant, and I'm waiting for my pie in the sky when I die, has also been a foundation in black spirituality for refusing to obey any master but Jesus. And actually, in King's theology, he develops it that way, finally. Jesus is my master, therefore, Governor Wallace is not. And while I will respect the rule of law when law is just, if the law is unjust, I will rebel against the law. I will be civilly disobedient. And also 19th century feminists did the same thing. The women whose lives were changed by the Pentecostal movements and the evangelical revivals came to believe that the only authority in their life was God acting in their life, that was the presence of the Spirit, was Jesus. And so women first argued that women shouldn't be obedient to their husbands on the basis that women should only be obedient to Jesus. And if your husband asks you to do something contrary to what Jesus wants you to do, then you should disobey your husband. So that obedience has been a foundation for righteous rebellion. So then the question is, so the questions become very delicate. How can we speak about being faithful to God without connecting it to human structures of obedience? And we have not done very well doing that always in our religious traditions. So those are some of the more finer shadings. But then there's another question, which is obedience itself, if obedience even to God involves self-destruction, is that really God's purpose for us? So that criticism is harder to answer. That one comes closer to the heart of the relationship between the self and God.
Obedience is often expressed as the finest expression of love, perfect love. Mm-hmm. Obedience expresses perfect love.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you express perfect love then, beyond obedience?
Yeah.
Now, you said that, I was thinking, well, we were given choice, we were given free will, and we are given grace, God chooses us, but then mm-hmm. our answer back is love, but to mm-hmm. me, love is not obedience.
Yeah,
love
that's
was commitment, love was a choice, obedience, I guess I see another one too.
Yeah. This is the really good way to formulate the theological question I'm raising. Is obedience an expression of love? Or if not, what is love? Or what is loving God? Maybe we can just hold that question there.
Freedom or restriction.
Yeah. What did Jackie want to say?
I missed the first part, and I'm sorry about that. But from what I've heard since I've been in, I would maybe raise, and maybe this is too simplistic, but I've appreciated that the feminist view has allowed us to expand the notion of sin, in that oftentimes pride was said to be the sin. Oftentimes for women that was not the case. If they were not too prideful, they didn't often have enough pride. And so sin has taken on more of a relational view, which is kind of what you touched on. And I'm wondering if there's a way to reframe obedience without the notion of a subject, and to talk about obedience to the relationship, which would imply not obedience to a person or to an object or to an authority, but an obedience to the relationship with that person or God or whatever, mm-hmm. which implies more honesty, which implies forthrightness or a willingness to treasure the relationship, or be obedient in some way to the value of the relationship, which means then you do question, you do challenge, you do not obey the person, but you obey the relationship, or you obey what that means to be in relationship.
So to be in relation, to maintain relationship, would become the rule, so to
to
work with the language.
In a healthy way.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the obedience.
Mm-hmm. And that's similar to what, I don't know your name, but you were saying about surrendering to nature, you said, of opening yourself to more relationality. That's also what Rauschenbusch meant when he criticized the king subject metaphor. He said that righteousness should have to do with our relationality with one another, which is what you're speaking about too. What
so
did you want to say?
This comes under the question of where the word obedient or obedience becomes replaced by the word commitment.
You asking a question about that? Yeah, see, the question I would ask Jackie is, would you want to retain the use of the word obedience? If so, why? The word obedience is an interesting word etymologically. It's related to the word obeisance, to bow to another. And it means, it's actually root is the word to hear. But it means it's a... let's see, what is the etymology? I forgot. It means to hear and to do. So it carries, the word carries a command, the carrying out of command.
It's something from the Arabian Nights or something, to hear is to obey.
Yeah. Yeah, obey comes from the word that means to hear and to do. Hear the word of God and do it. Do you want to offer any reflections about that? Mm-hmm. Commitment to me has quite different feeling associations from obey. It's a different structure of relationship. In obedience, we don't want to just play word games. What I really wanted to reflect about is what is the structure of our relationship to God? Commitment to me conjures up already a sense of heart and self acting, making a choice. Obedience is the associations I think you find in the literature with the word obedience is always not a gesture of presence. I commit. I'm here. I'll be here for you. I will continue to be in relationship with you. I'll be present to you. I want you to be present to me. Obedience is a bowing out. You will be present and I will be absent. These are the subtle associations of the language, and the issue isn't what do the words mean. Others of you may have different associations with the word. The question is, in our relationship to God, here's the way to put it theologically, in our relationship to God, are we to be present or are we to be absent, ideally? Does that make sense? Is the ideal for us to cease having a will, get our will out of the way, get our negative feelings out of the way, and become malleable, or a channel through, or an empty vessel into which the Spirit is poured, or clay that is molded by another. Is that the spiritual ideal? This is the we have this language in our tradition, and for many of us, it's been very important. It's been the essence of our prayer and our discipline, to become malleable, to become empty, to become a channel, to be an instrument played by another, used by another. But I'm suggesting that all the critical voices from different perspectives say that this malleability and submission or obedience is a form of absenting the self, or at its worst, excising aspects of the self. And is this the essence of what being related to God means, or is it something else? Is it something else that we might speak of in terms of presence? Being present as one who has will to choose, being present with feelings, being present not as... I think being present as one who's open to the presence of others, but also being present as one who is willing and prepared to act in the world and not just receive. This is the where the balance comes in. Men have been cultivated to be actors and not receivers. Women have been cultivated to be receivers and not actors. We were to be acted upon. In our relationship to God, we have often been cultivated to be receivers and not actors. But the critical issues for me move me towards, and the critical experience of self-destruction leads me to want to affirm that the right relationship to God is one in which the soul is a presence rather than an absence. So not an empty vessel,